gorgeous day in New Hampshire, October 24th. It is a Thursday. You are lucky. You are tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. I'm a little bit nervous. I've got a two-hour sort of speech this afternoon right after I leave here to a bunch of adults, I believe. It's going to be at one of those extension college extension things. Yes. Where adults want to go back to school or whatever. I don't know what it's
called. It's going to be adults who look like me with gray
hair. Exactly. They're like sponges. They want to keep learning. They want to keep learning. And they figure between 80 and 100 will be showing up. And it'll be interesting. By the way, I invited Dean Spiliotis because he is our Rethink the Week, and they hear him on New Hampshire Public Radio. And I invited Nancy West from In Depth New Hampshire.
Yeah.
So again, someone who's trying to create a sort of online nonprofit newspaper, which is unfortunately the only model that seems to be left in America. When you kind of look at VT Digger, for example, over in Vermont, which is wildly successful, and I think Nancy is trying to replicate Vermont, but then again, it's Vermont. I hate to break it to you, New Hampshire. We're always so depressing when it comes. We're the Mississippi of the North. That's all I have to say. We may be rich, but we're the Mississippi.
And Vermont is a red state, not in the Republican
sense. Yes, right, exactly. It's a lefty
like the
state.
Red babies.
It's a lefty. And they would support news and information and facts, not New Hampshire. Come on, you know? Why bother with the facts? Let's just get to some conclusion.
Yeah.
Anyway,
really.
Darling, so where do you want to begin? And then we're going to be talking about the election in Canada. So.
Yeah. I heard Larry Summers on the radio the other day arguing about the wealth tax. And other than the fact that it's absolutely chilling to listen to Larry Summers because he's
Barack Obama brought Larry Summers into his
whatever. That's true. But, I mean, Summers just has that feel of not just a professorial but
is it arrogant?
He's arrogant and obnoxious and arrogant. He looks down his nose at pretty much everybody. He was thrown out of Harvard.
I know, because he is arrogant and a jerk and looks down at everybody.
And sexist.
Oh, totally.
And sexist. It was about women in the faculty.
And who's proposing the wealth tax? Is it a woman and a faculty member from Harvard? This is a personal vendetta by Larry Summers. But keep going.
I don't know about that.
And let's remember, she's Harvard. She's a professor. She's female. And she suggested the wealth tax.
Right.
That's more than a trifecta for him. You know, that's every reason to really hate it.
Right. But he has all these cockamamie ideas. One that just struck me in particular is he said that if we have a wealth tax, it's not going to be able to be effective. It could never be effective because the rich will just find new ways to stop reporting their assets and everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking,
they'll break the law, you mean?
Yeah, but don't you think the rich are already maximizing their deductions and hiding their money in offshore accounts? And
I've seen those post office
boxes and stuff like that. I mean, the Summers really think that their accountants and lawyers who are helping them out now for big bucks, those guys aren't already finding all the ways to hide everything?
Can I give you an answer to that?
Yeah.
And then here's an answer to that. If they figure out a way to hide or move to the Cayman Islands or move to Aruba, wherever they're going to go to, we won't notice because they didn't contribute when they were here. Hold on to that, everyone. Remember, if they leave to hide their wealth, will it really matter? No, because they've been hiding their wealth forever. We just didn't have a capacity to take anything from it and to tax it. So now they're going to go through all these hoops. They're going to go to some little offshore island in a post office box because they're going to hide their wealth even more. And frankly, I hope we put laws in so that what they're doing is illegal. So maybe they'll be on top of the teeth of a wealth tax. There may be an illegal act for hiding your funds in those offshore accounts. But more importantly, we weren't able to touch it now. If they go, we won't notice. Let's be honest. We won't notice.
Or we won't be able to touch it anyway.
But that's my point.
All the assets will be in Swiss bank accounts.
But think about it. If I haven't gotten a dime from you today and you have to go through all these hoops to hide your dime, well then, mazel tov. You know, because I didn't get a dime now and you're going to go through these hoops to hide it. My point is, at some point in time, I hope the European Union starts talking about a wealth tax. I hope everybody does so they have no place to hide.
And some transparency they'll need over there because the Swiss bank accounts,
they're getting more and more.
No European government can look at because they're all top secret. Summers' argument is essentially the same argument Republicans and corporatists have been making forever. Basically, you help out the corporations and it'll lift all boats.
Yeah, it's your boat.
Yeah. I mean, he looks at everything from the point of view of corporations and Wall Street, and that's just not the way to look at it. Elizabeth Warren, to her credit, is always talking about, and now she's got other candidates talking about, the fact that these 1% and the top corporations have control over everything. They control the economy, they control politics, and the other 99% of us are we the people, and we ought to have some power too.
But they keep talking. So, you know what? Remember when Bernie Sanders said there really shouldn't be billionaires, where he made that statement about why do we need billionaires? So they interviewed one of the billionaires who, by the way, also owns the National Enquirer, just to let you know. This is the billionaire that CNBC interviewed. And he was talking about the wealth tax and trashing it and talking about how important people like him were. And he was a hedge fund manager and how they create services and jobs and the nation needs them. If you read about his background, most of the money in his hedge fund is his. So not only does he control the National Enquirer, which basically plays to lies and mistrust and divides us, but it turns out that when you actually look at the services he's providing, it's for moving his own money around. Where's my middle finger up in stereo?
Yeah, really.
Oh, God. And CNBC never gave you the rest of the story. All they did was say he's rich and hates the wealth tax. They didn't tell you these details. I had to tell people the details because CNBC could not afford to find the rest of the story out. Get real.
And then Professor Summers, who purports to know some things as a professor, throws out the McGovern example. If the Democratic Party nominates somebody who's the least bit progressive, you're going to get trounced just like McGovern did, as if the Georgia McGovern election had nothing to do with any other issue other than McGovern being progressive. Like he had that fiasco with his vice presidential nominee undergoing shock therapy.
and God, that's right.
And he was running against Nixon and the dirty tricks.
Yes,
do you remember Watergate, the burglars and the dirty tricks squad?
So let's
He was running against.
So let's just say something. If we had reelected Jimmy Carter and we had really gotten involved with climate issues and the consequences of oil, coal, and gas, where would we be today as a world when it comes to climate change? If we had elected McGovern, would we see the gross inequality in America that we see today? So let's point back to those guys who you said, oh, see what happened to them? And I'm thinking, yeah, and look what happened to us. Who got screwed and who got enhanced? That's all. And I look at those, all you little people, that's right. You hate those people. Why? Because you got screwed by those rich people. I mean, come on, do the math. God, I can't stand it, Ken. I want to just play it out for people. Let them talk, and then I want to respond. And nobody responds to Larry Summers. They just let him.
Right.
It's pablum.
Yeah. Right. And he comes across, you know, I'm this Harvard professor and I'm smart and I have all this
experience. And my you-know-what doesn't smell.
Exactly. I have all this experience. You listen to me. And then he puts forth these idiotic arguments. It shows how desperate he is. I mean, if all you've got to argue against the wealth tax is George McGovern,
right.
You know, you don't have any real arguments.
Exactly.
Or, gee, a rising tide lifts all boats. You know, right. It's the same BS that
how many people the hedge fund managers employ? How many people the hedge fund? That's all I wanted you to know. And are you invested in a hedge fund? Me neither.
All right, everyone.
You heard from Ken yesterday because he was talking about the election in Canada. So we decided that we have to actually go to Canada to talk about the Canadian elections. So joining us in a few minutes is going to be Steve Paikin, who is the host of TV Ontario's The Agenda. He is an award-winning TV host. Up until, I think, this election, he's probably moderated every conversation between the leaders of the party as they try to figure out who should be the next PM. And this has been an interesting election. And I really wanted Steve Paikin to come on, talk to us about the results, which were fascinating, and also sort of read the tea leaves as we look into the future as to what is going to happen in Canada. And my favorite thing was that Slate.com had a very cute article, and it was entitled, "Everyone in Canada Got a Medal," that everybody was claiming victory. Only in Canada can everyone, even the losers, claim victory. So I thought, well, how is that even possible? And then as I was starting to read the article at Slate.com, I could figure out how they were able to manage the spin. But I want people to sort of begin to look around the world and understand it isn't just our election in 2020 that we need to pay attention to. We need to sort of take a look at the political landscape that's happening all over the country, whether it's Switzerland, whether it's Canada, whether it's Mexico, because again, we are threaded together, whether we like it or not. And the implications of the Canadian election, I think, are very, very important for us, because I think what we also need to figure out is where was the schism in Canada? You know, what was the real fight about? I mean, Justin Trudeau had come in, you know, at the very beginning as sort of the golden boy. He lost some of that golden boy edge by the time he ended up running for re-election for a lot of reasons. But my understanding is that one of the great sort of schisms for the Canadians is about climate change. And while I always think of Canada as being more enlightened than us when it comes to climate, there are certain provinces in Canada where, guess what? It is oil. It is pipeline. It is gas. It is very important to the economies of those provinces. And when it comes to the issue of climate change, if you're going to start suggesting that you don't want to sort of continue to pursue that, you're going to lose a significant portion of the Canadian population who does not, in fact, want to support you. So as I was looking at the Slate.com article, it just begins this way. Monday's national election was a thoroughly Canadian affair. No single party won an outright victory, but all the major party leaders found reason to celebrate the result. And then, as the author of the piece from Slate.com writes, everyone got a medal. And he goes on to say, the most important result is that voters re-elected Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party to a second term. Ah, but here's the kicker. But with a reduced seat count. He returns to Ottawa with 157 seats in the House of Commons. Now, for those of you who don't know, you need to have a 170-seat threshold to actually claim a majority. So he is relatively significantly below that 170-seat threshold. And so now the problem is, if all the other parties come together, they could, in fact, trigger another election. But despite the fact that he lost his majority, I love politicians, and Trudeau, unfortunately, you're acting like a typical politician. He said the following. He celebrated the results and said, quote, on Monday night, you are sending our Liberal team back to work, back to Ottawa, with a clear mandate. God, how does losing a majority be a clear mandate? I am not quite sure how he gets to spin this. But here's the other point of the conversation we're going to have with Steve Paikin. Trudeau's main rival, Conservative Party leader Andrew Scheer, also sounded upbeat. Quote, our party is strong. We are united and we are on the march, he announced, even though he is marching back into opposition with 121 seats, short of his hopes, but still an improvement from 2015. And I think this is really important, everyone, to understand. But this is the kind of interesting nub about how many seats Trudeau got, how many seats the Conservatives got. Because listen to this. This is an interesting backstory on the actual numbers. Justin Trudeau didn't lose the Canadian federal election outright, but he had about as bad an outcome is possible short of actually doing that. His Liberal Party lost 27 seats. I just mentioned that. More ominously, listen, this is so, oh God, how we do elections is fascinating. More ominously, his share of the popular vote dropped 6.5 points from 30. So everyone, he is on the road. He knows that we're calling his cell phone. He encouraged us to do that. He may, in fact, be calling right now. So we're going to be grabbing him as he's sort of on the move. Anyway, so his Liberal Party lost 27 seats. More ominously, listen to this. Justin Trudeau's share of the popular vote dropped 6.5 points from 39.5% in the 2015 election to 33%. This year, Canada's Conservatives came in second in the seat count, but won the largest share of the popular vote, 34.4%. So you know how we sort of bitch and moan about what's happening in the states and about, you know, Hillary Clinton got millions more votes than Donald Trump, but Donald Trump won because he had the Electoral College. Well, it kind of interesting appears that as a lot of, you know, progressives and liberals are sort of crowing about how successful Justin Trudeau was, when you actually crunch the numbers and look at the numbers underlying how many seats they got, it turns out that the Conservatives, while not able to, you know, get the numbers they thought they were going to be able to get, doing significantly better than the last election But the most important number, I want everyone to hear this again because it's really important. Numbers matter. Numbers matter. It turns out that Trudeau's Liberal Party only got 33% in this year's election, but the Conservatives got 34.4. So it's going to be fascinating. Now, the thing that I don't quite understand, and I'm hoping that we can grab him again, he's on the road in Canada. What does that tell you? Trudeau was quoted as saying the other day that he is going to rule out a coalition government. Now, he doesn't want to form a coalition government, even though his party has lost enough seats that to some extent he really needs to do that. And so what it said in this article was that while the Liberals retained power, they did, as I mentioned before, fell short of a majority. But he said he'd be sitting down with other party leaders to discuss parliamentary support for his minority government. And so his thought, I guess, is that the general election saw the Liberals' representation in the House of Commons reduced, and therefore he still thinks he can hold a minority government. And while he offers a tone of regret, I love it, a tone of regret. But I just want people to sort of begin to understand what's going on here. And my understanding is that the big split was about climate change. Isn't that interesting? And that's because Alberta and all those other provinces that are so dependent on fracking and oil in Saskatchewan, they obviously, they don't want to hear. And let's do like a come to Jesus moment on this. Here is the problem, everyone. I think it's not that they don't believe in climate change. I think they get it. What they believe is a livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think at some point, we were just talking at the very beginning of the show about George McGovern, and I mentioned Jimmy Carter. Imagine if Jimmy Carter had won re-election, where we would be on climate change. Imagine if George McGovern would have won, where we would be on infrastructure investment and the grotesque inequality that we currently are seeing today, that a lot of those things would have been repaired or addressed. So I think we need to respect people's frustration and fear about their job future. And if you really believe in climate change, then I think we need to belly up to the bar and we have to write a couple of checks. And one of the checks is a check to people who will lose their jobs because they are sacrificing for the good of the world. They're sacrificing for the good of the climate. They're sacrificing for the good of the country. And this is a sacrifice, everyone. They still technically have a job. They still could sell oil, coal, and gas. But we're asking them to stop. That's different than a company sending its company to Mexico. That's different from somebody going bankrupt. That's different. We are literally asking them to basically change the course of their lives to serve the public good. And in a lot of ways, you know what I think of this as? I think of this as what is it when I'm having a mind fart. When the state comes in and they have to take some land in order to build a highway.
Eminent domain.
This is a form of eminent domain. Think about it.
Eminent domain requires compensation. You have to give just compensation to the people you take the land from, the actual value.
Exactly.
And that's what we have to do for the people that are working in these industries and also, I suppose, the investors in the industries. Like people talk about the assault weapons.
Right.
So buy them back.
Right, exactly. But we really should start looking at this as a form of eminent domain. Mm-hmm. And I've never heard anyone ever make that suggestion. I'll be honest with you, Ken. But I think we have to do that. And I'm going to make it, again, personal for me. So I'm running for governor in 92. And of course, what do we know about the North Country? The North Country exists back then. It still had paper mills. Okay? It was cutting down trees. The timber industry defined that. Tourism in the timber industry and the mills defined it. But what we already knew back in 91 and 92 was those mills were going away. All right? And people were frightened and hysterical. Well, a lot of my friends who are, you know, environmentalists love the idea that the mills were going away. You wouldn't have to worry about the pollution. You wouldn't have to worry about the sulfur smell. You wouldn't have to worry about them cutting down all those trees. They saw it as the answer to a lot of concerns they had. I looked at it as a financial disaster for people up there.
And it still is.
And I said to my environmentalists, you can't live in a frickin' bubble. You have to start recognizing that if you want to get to goal, that you have to make, you have to build a bridge with those people and you have to help them get to the next place. Mm-hmm. You just can't be elated that your agenda is resolved as they have no economic future. They starve. They're captive tenants because if you don't have a job and you don't have an industry, how do you sell your house? Let's remember, how do you sell your house? How do you go to a doctor? Why? Because you don't have a job and you don't have health care. All right. I mean, you don't understand the consequences of their lives. And I understand why you're happy,
right.
But I think you have a moral obligation to help them get to the next place. So where are we today? I'll never forget this. So we had a Republican mayor of Berlin, which is up in the North Country. And this is a couple of years after I had already lost and kind of walked off the political scene. And this Republican mayor who, you know, trashes services, doesn't believe in government, yada, yada, yada. What was he begging for? He was begging for the federal prison and the state prison to come
right.
to his county.
Right.
Now, why was he doing it? Because he needed jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the irony here is, you know how a lot of people don't want prisons? They were desperate for prisons. And not only about the jobs, Ken, but they had benefits, the people that were going to be working at those prisons, which meant they could keep their hospitals open.
Hmm. Well, and also the people that were in the industry and were making decent money now could go to the stores and buy stuff. The restaurants
yep.
would sell lunch
yes,
or breakfast.
Exactly,
and,
exactly.
You know, there was some economy because if you have everybody unemployed up there, as it was when the
yep.
mills closed, then the whole downtown
yep.
folds up because nobody's doing business.
Yeah, no, it's
buying.
It's unfortunate. But I just want mm-hmm. want people to know that I think we have to start looking at the concept of eminent domain, and I think we have to redefine it. I think – and that's another reason, Ken. I want single payer. I want to take mm-hmm. away at least the fear of what happens when you lose your job.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be because of climate change. That may be because they moved your company across the pond. That may be because of a bankruptcy. But for whatever reason, we have to begin to consider that because we have to at least give people something that's stable in their lives if it turns out it's not a job. Oh,
right.
My God.
Right.
I'm just – it's shocking to me how people don't understand. There is an urgency here.
And as long as we're on the healthcare issue, I want to chime in again with – my idea from the other day that people are jumping all over Elizabeth Warren about how she is going to pay for Medicare for all. But I think we really need to have the media and the voters asking the other candidates, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Joe Biden, how are you going to pay for everybody's health care if we don't have something like Medicare for All? How do we pay for the 40 million people that are underinsured or uninsured mm-hmm. when they go to the emergency room and costs everybody a ton of money to mm-hmm. give them ordinary health care?
Mm-hmm.
And what do we do about all of the costs? If you don't do preventive care, they don't have a real PCP. They only have the emergency room
right.
when they get very, very sick. Then all of health care costs too much.
So what do we know about the average cost of a family health care covered by insurance is about $20,000, okay? That's what it costs, about
mm-hmm.
$20,000. So there was a wonderful article that was written, I think it was at Vox, and the article said, so why don't we just call private insurance a tax? That's what it is.
Yeah.
Because they are taxing your income. Okay?
Absolutely.
Your employer's income, your income, and they are charging you because between your employer and you and your out-of-pocket and your out-of-network and your copay,
deductibles,
it's 20. It's not like all of a sudden you're spending money out of air. We are already spending more money than any country in the world.
Mm.
Repeat. And what do we have? We still have a significant number of uninsured and underinsured, and the number one driver of bankruptcy in America is medical.
Mm-hmm.
More than mortgage bankruptcies, more than all that other stuff. It turns out it's medical that's driving people into bankruptcy. So I just want people to know, it's not like we're not spending the money.
Mm-hmm.
Stop it. I'm going to start calling private insurance a tax. It is. It is a tax. If you don't like the word, then guess what? I'm sticking it in between private tax insurance. I'm
mm-hmm.
sorry, because people are so afraid of the word that I'm going to use it on the private insurance industry because they are taxing you. And what's worse is that they're inefficient. And what's worse is they pocket a lot of profit. And what's worse is that they drop you. Think about that. You wouldn't have that if you had Medicare for All. And on that note, we need to go to a little labor history. And I'm so sorry I missed Steve Pakin, but we'll grab him next week. I promise you. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1940. That was the day that the federally mandated 40-hour work week went into effect for U.S. workers. The 40-hour week had been passed as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Making 5 days of 8 hours work the national standard had long been a top goal for labor. For decades, union members organized, demonstrated, went on strike, and even died for the right to work 8 hours. Labor argued that reducing the long, unregulated hours of toil was a matter of workers' health and safety. It was also a matter of dignity. A more reasonable work week would give workers the time to spend with their families, to pursue other interests, and to have a full life outside of the grinding schedule demanded by many bosses. Before the turn of the 20th century, the 8-hour day movement declared 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will as their motto. In 1886, nationwide rallies and strikes for 8 hours took place on May 1st. Today, May Day is celebrated as a workers' holiday around the world in remembrance of that struggle. In 1888, the American Federation of Labor took up the cause, and the Carpenters Union became the standard bearer for the 8-hour day. 10 years later, the United Mine Workers Union members won the 8-hour workday. In 1916, the Adamson Act made 8 hours the standard for interstate railroad workers. A decade after that, Ford Motor Company, a leader in U.S. industry, established the 40-hour workweek. Each of these victories were a step along the way to making the 8-hour day a reality and the law of the land. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Rice is often grown in flooded fields called paddies. When it's farmed this way, it uses more water than any other crop in the world. But rice plants do not need to be submerged in water all season long.
If you keep rice watered at certain periods, then you don't have to flood the field.
Nazirik Amin is an organic farmer in Tacoma Park, Maryland. His rice grows much like a conventional vegetable crop, in rows with drip irrigation.
To keep the field saturated when we know the plants need the water the most. And with that, we've been able to produce rice with about a third of the water that's used in paddy production.
Amin is not alone in growing rice this way. Around the world, people are experimenting with less water-intensive methods, partly because flooded fields emit a lot of methane, a potent greenhouse gas. Growing rice with drip irrigation, however, reduces methane emissions. It conserves water, and recent research suggests it can improve yields, too. So there could be many benefits to this approach, whether it's used on a small farm in suburban D.C. or in the vast rice fields of Asia. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Told this guy where I was from. He said, "Oh, Canada." Kind of laughed it off. It was funny, huh? Yeah. Come on. 1, 2, 1, 2. Mic check. 1, 2, 1, 2. Yeah. Yeah, from the land of the lost, trans-Canada cross, patriotic in a honor with my hand on my heart. From the greatest of lakes, to the greenest of greens, to the rockiest mountains and everything in between. Oh Canada, oh, you're no fan of us, cause the movie and TV shows are so amateur. Yeah, we laugh it off, that don't really bother me. Look, we ain't serious unless you really gotta be. Humorous attitude, like kids in a hall, the Jim Carrey, Mike Myers, how we claiming them all. It's the great white north, home of the funniest actors, the fun of the joke with an abundance of laughter.
This is the Attitude Authority artist and producer Ken Barnes. Poor Ken. We put on O Canada because we thought we were getting Steve Paikin, host of TV Ontario, the agenda on TV Ontario. But he called us right as we finished that last half hour. So we'll grab him next week because he is too important. And again, we need to figure out how Trudeau is going to sort of manage and thread the needle for leadership in Canada. That has an impact on us. And maybe it's also a roadmap for us because we think we're the only ones that's kind of screw things up. No, no, no. We share share that wealth. Anyway, who sings and O Canada?
It's a group called Classified. And I'm going to say it's kind of nice to have the song O Canada not just be a national anthem, but have a rapper there.
I know. Mike Myers, all those things. It's
funny
great.
Funny things about,
Canada.
Canada and America.
Right. In a charming way. In a charming way. Well, speaking of charming, joining us right now is Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics. He's a professor of political science at Iowa State. And if it's Thursday, he joins us. So, Stefan, are you there? Hold on, everyone. We're trying to reconnect. Oh, with Stefan. This is one of those days where all you want to do is like start from scratch. We're trying this new technology. Actually, unfortunately, it's probably not new technology, but for us, it's new technology. And we're trying to connect with Stefan Schmidt on his computer at Skype. And we're going to sort of see if we can reconnect with him. So anyway, we're going to try to do that again. So I'm about to give a speech this afternoon, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the show. And there were so many things that I wanted to talk to this audience about that I kept doing is finding little nuggets of information and then passing them along. And one of them, oh my God, it was so depressing. So New Hampshire is one of a handful of states, I think five or six in the United States, that has no minimum wage. None. Niente. Okay? That means that if the feds decide to drop the minimum wage, we'll have none. If the feds decide to lower the minimum wage, what is it, $7.25 an hour? Ours will go down to whatever the Fed is. But we don't have our own individual set minimum wage. And there's only a handful of states that don't have that. So who are the handful of states? Mississippi, Alabama, I think it's Tennessee, South Carolina, Louisiana, all these states that you're kind of like, oh, my God, what the hell is wealthy New Hampshire in New England with all this incredible potential and not being able to, in fact, you know, have a rational minimum wage, given the fact that we have such an incredibly expensive standard of living. I mean, the cost of housing here is through the roof. We have an expensive cost of food. Energy costs are ridiculous. And yet, over and over again, and I suddenly realized that, you know, one of the reasons why we can get away with that crap, and the reason we can get away with it, is that because we are surrounded, we're a long, slender state, everyone, New Hampshire. I always describe us as having all borders and no depth, okay? And that means because we are surrounded by states that have relatively high minimum wages, we're kind of forced to adjust the wage that we pay people because of outside influence. Because people could say, hey, I could just cross the border and go to Maine, or hey, I could just cross the border and go to Vermont or Massachusetts. And as a result, technically, we don't have to raise the minimum wage. But in a lot of ways, it's the environment in which we are in that actually kind of forces us, and the competition for jobs, because we have very low unemployment, that, you know, market forces and geography force us to do that. But that's not an excuse. I'm just going to tell you something right now. That is not an excuse. And we really need to begin to look at this, because you want to make sure that there is a rational and reasonable floor so people can afford to live here. And I think that that's really important. All right, everyone. I think we're going to be grabbing Stefan Schmidt by phone. I don't know what happened. Stefan, are you there?
Yeah. You know, you couldn't get your Canadian guest on. My Wi-Fi just crashed. I was listening to your entire show, and it was fabulous, by the way.
Was it all right, even though we didn't have Steve Paikin? I did okay. I just want to make sure.
I'm sorry. It's the day for connections not to work well, but I thought your comments about Canada were so interesting because, of course, Canada, Israel, to some extent now the United States,
right,
they're basically gridlocked.
Yes.
They basically can't really legislate. They can't address the serious problems that exist,
exactly,
because nobody has a majority.
Exactly.
And in order to get legislation done and get government to work, you know, you have to have the legal majority in order to initiate programs and improve things. And none of us have that.
I know. It's the lack of stability and security is not only reflected in the voting patterns, but it's also going to be reflected in how the leadership pattern is. The Guardian newspaper had a headline. Listen to this, Stefan. Trudeau faces rough road as Canada's minority parties lay out their conditions. The prime minister faces a landscape that will require skill to pass legislation and rivals who could unseat his government on a whim. On a whim.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. Talk about being on a short leash. It's not good.
You know, it's not good, Arnie. And the thing is that you and I and many of us celebrate the diversity that exists when you have more than one party, like, you know, Russia or North Korea or whatever.
Right.
But if you have a division, either too many parties like Israel. I mean, Israel is a nutty political system in which a tiny party that, you know, has a few thousand members and one member of the Knesset, it can make the difference in creating a government. And in Canada, this division, you know, has left Canada basically toothless.
We're talking about threading the needle, and that, you know, he could have another election based on the whim of one of the minority parties, and I mean minority parties. Just listen to this. Here's his dilemma, and he tried to thread the needle. Remember, if you heard me talk about climate change as being kind of the cutting edge for the election. So here's what happened. He got criticized by both sides. Why?
Yeah.
He brought in a carbon tax to fight the climate crisis, but get this, he also paid billions to rescue the stalled pipeline project. Oh my God. So nobody likes
him.
Exactly.
You can't win.
Exactly. You know, I mean, my dad used to say, "Pooper, get off the pot." That was my father's favorite line. Every time I would try to figure out, I was like this mugwump. I was trying to figure out how to make everybody happy. And my father said, "You can't. You can't." And the reason why you have to put your stake in the ground and make a decision is, if nothing else, one, you have a base that will support you. Okay, that's really important. And then you can convince the folks that really hate you that there is a reason why you did this, and you understand their anger and you need to help address it. But like putting in the pipeline isn't the answer when we're facing climate change. Getting you a job will be the answer. It just ain't a pipeline.
Not to mention issues like democracy. You're being honest with the public when you tell them you have a position, and you're consistent in that position.
Oh,
at least you know what you're getting when you vote.
Yes, that's absolutely. The other thing you should never do, ever, is go to India and dress up like the local people in India do and have photo shoots all over the Taj Mahal and stuff.
Yeah.
Because basically it's insulting. It's not being, you know, kind and recognizing other cultures. It's basically, you know, mocking them in some respect, even though that's not what he meant to do. But that cost him a lot of goodwill, you know?
Well, there's so much goodwill that's lost for him. But then we have Donald Trump, who thrives on trashing goodwill. I mean, that's all. I mean, it's almost like he has a list on his desk and he checks, who can I offend today? How often can I offend them? What lie can I put out today? I mean, I almost feel like there is a roadmap for him, but it's a roadmap I would never want to be on. And then I'm looking at like what he said about the Kurds and Syria. Oh my God, it's Brave New World, it's 1984, it's SOMA, it's all these crazy things. What you see is not what you see. What you hear is not what you hear.
Well, it is. It's new. It's, you know, it's George Orwell's Newspeak, you know, where you say, this is a fabulous thing and it saved thousands of lives, when in fact it's a horrible thing and it's costing thousands of lives. You know, George Orwell was so brilliant, and I don't understand how Americans, many Americans, are not seeing this and saying, this is not good for the country, even if you like Trump, even if you like the issues that he's pushing. There's a bigger thing coming. And also, when you set this precedent, I've said this before, Arnie, when the Democrats get elected and get someone in the White House, which will happen, you know, unless the pendulum stops swinging, then the Democrat is going to have all this precedent that Trump has set.
Yeah.
And conservatives and Republicans are going to absolutely hate that, because the Democrat is going to do all the things that they don't like and is going to try to get away with it.
It's already happened from previous times, because the Republicans, Lindsey Graham and all of them, were trashing the Democratic administrations before for they said you're abusing power, you're not going through the right procedures, and now they're doing the same thing.
Well, let me.
Sure.
They changed their position.
So here's my question. What he said about the Kurds was so disgusting and such a blatant, brutal, immoral lie. immoral lie, given the fact that they're blowing up the houses, they're killing them, they're on the roads, they're heading into a winter with no shelter, they're pouring across the border. Why don't the Democrats take the words that he is saying, as he's saying it right from his mouth, and then do a split screen and say he's saying the Kurds are happy? And then you see the mothers crying, and you see them holding the dead bodies, and you see them blowing up the houses. Why aren't the Democrats doing a visual, buying it on Fox News, buying it on Rush Limbaugh, buying it on all those stations, and saying, wait a minute, a dead child is success? Losing your home is success? Tennessee, would you want to see your child dead? Would you want to go out into the wilderness of the mountains because of Donald Trump? But that's exactly what he's doing with the Kurds. This is not success. This is a horror story.
And also, I agree with you. The Democrats are really not maximizing the essentially the political agenda that they would like to pursue. The other thing is have a split screen showing, you know, Putin and Erdogan, and saying, look, you know, we've turned over a vital area that we've lost thousands of lives ourselves, hundreds of thousands of local civilians and military from all these different places like Iraq and Syria and so on. And now we just turned it over to basically Putin and are giving up our influence and our ability to essentially change some of history in the Middle East. That would be compelling to some people, but they're not doing anything.
Not to mention the nuclear weapons that are left behind somewhere.
Or the ISIS fighters that are now being released
and
into the
ISIS fighters.
All right, so here's
the ISIS fighters.
So
yeah,
I want to sit down with the nimnums in my whatever used to be my party. I don't even know if I have a party anymore. But anyway, here's what I want to do. One of the things we know is that the soft spot right now in the electorate are suburban women. Okay? They are the soft spot. And that's true, especially if you want to change the dynamic in Texas, if you want to change the dynamic in country. That is the most movable population that could move into the other side. The reason why the story of the Kurds is effective with that population is, while we may be xenophobic and we don't focus on places like Syria or Turkey, we do understand that he's a liar and that what we've done is brutally destroy a stable place for these people, and that that's immoral, and that they used to be our friend. They fought for us when it came to fighting. But the other thing is that you use that as your baseline. So there's that level of immorality that you can play to for suburban women and the lies coming out of his mouth. But here's the second part to that story, because you need to start there. And the second part is the fact that now ISIS fighters that had been in prisons and been warehoused, and the Kurds had been really responsible for keeping them under wraps, they're now foaming. They're now going to go into the environment. And remind everyone about 9/11.
Sure.
Because what Donald Trump keeps saying is, no, they're going to go home to Europe. And I'm thinking, no, they're not as angry at going home as they are at us. And all it takes is a plane ticket. And we have seen what happened. We were brought to our knees by plane tickets. We can be brought to our knees again by plane tickets. And what we have done, both by doing this destructive thing to the Kurds and now unleashing ISIS terrorist fighters back into the environment, is, guess what, I would say to the suburban women, they are making you less safe.
Sure. And let's add the fact that not a lot, but a certain number of them are actually from the U.S.
Yes.
Go to Minneapolis.
Yes, exactly.
And talk to people there. A lot of Somalis left and went to fight with ISIS for the caliphate.
Yep.
And if they're released, they're going to want to come back to the suburbs of Minneapolis.
Yeah, no, I'm beside myself, because I don't understand that. I understand that the focus, and everyone's talking about impeachment, but that's not a storyline yet. It's happening behind closed doors. Republicans are apoplectic about that. And I guess I want to talk to you about the stunt that happened the other day. So they go into the skiff, they bring their cell phones, they order pizza. I mean, they basically say, but you know what this says? This is now why you understand why they don't like the FBI, they don't like the CIA, they don't like, you know, they don't like the dark state, whatever they call it, the deep state. But at the same time, they are now putting all of us at risk, because there is a reason for the skiff other than impeachment. I mean, can I remind you, there is a reason for the skiff other than impeachment, and it's called our safety and our security. But apparently they don't believe that either.
Well, they don't care.
They don't care. Yeah.
They don't care, and the theater of it, I mean, the reason we're talking about it is because, in a sense, it's so shocking. It's so unacceptable to violate a space where electronic devices are not permitted, and there are several good articles already. In fact, I do a lot of cyber stuff. As you know, I'm a member of the Information Assurance Program at Iowa State. I'm a member of the Strategic Command in Omaha. We have an alliance with them on cybersecurity.
Right.
And it is appalling to people who understand cybersecurity, because telephones, cell phones can be activated remotely, both the video and the audio. And when they went in there, they violated a space that is highly secure, and it's not acceptable. Hillary Clinton did that too, by the way. She went into a secure room in the State Department and insisted on bringing her BlackBerry in there. I'm shocked that security guards didn't just take it away from her. And I'm shocked that the guards, you know, there are police in Congress, that they allowed basically a mob to go into the room where this is secure. Why was there no security there?
I don't know.
I mean, what if a bunch of communists were to show up and protest and push their way into that room? Would they be able to do the same thing? I guess so.
I'm kind of overwhelmed by this. And at the same time, I keep thinking, so one of the rationales that we hear about why they're doing this behind closed doors in the SCIF is that they don't want people to compare information. Okay. And I get that. But let's be honest with each other. The people right now that are coming in, they're coming in from the Pentagon. They're coming in from the State Department. They're coming in as ambassadors. They're not going to compare information. They know exactly what they're going to say. So there is no safety and security that we're getting or added value by having them do it, you know, clandestinely and behind closed doors than if we did it publicly. The people that you worry about that might compare information are people coming from the Trump administration who aren't showing up anyway.
Yeah, but so, they didn't know that when they made the rules. They were expecting people to obey the law and show up.
No, but here's my point. We know now. Okay, so you can't claim that anymore, Ken. I mean, that may have been true last week. It wasn't true Monday. It wasn't true Tuesday. Mm-hmm. It wasn't true Wednesday. So you know what? That malarkey, that line doesn't work with me anymore. Open the doors. Start your public hearings.
I thought the exact same thing.
Thank you.
You know, just open it up and have these people testify publicly.
Right.
Because it looks suspicious to most people. Most people don't understand what you just said, which is the reason you do this is so you can compartmentalize the different people who do testimony. But, you know, those people have already communicated with each other anyway.
Exactly.
I mean, you don't think people in the State Department and Defense Department and the FBI, the CIA, who are specialists on Russia and Ukraine have already talked to each other? They go out for coffee. They go to a, you know, deep-fried chicken place in southern Washington, D.C. And talk? Of course they have.
Well, and let's remember, 46 members of the Republican Party could go enter the SCIF. So it wasn't that it was only open to Democrats. It was open to Republicans and Democrats. You were not allowed to bring in electronic equipment, but you were allowed to bring in a pencil and a pen. Okay?
They don't know how to write like that anymore.
Right. Well, but my point is, if you're worried about this information getting out so people can compare and contrast notes, guess who delivered it? I mean, I hate to say this, but you got to stop feeding me this like I'm stupid. I don't want to hear MSNBC one more time, you know, give an excuse like, get real. The way I'm offended by people moving lockstep with Donald Trump, I'm offended by people that are moving lockstep with Adam Schiff. I'm sorry. At some point in time, my brain has to enter this conversation. And my brain says, give me a shovel. This is bull.
Well, it's interesting that you both have the first thought, what you're saying now, open it up, because my first thought when I saw this nonsense was, lock them up. Why aren't the police?
Well,
in there, just myself, you don't need a bunch of communists, just any person you go in there with or without a phone, I'm going to be hauled to jail, buddy, and I'm not going to get out.
They should be jailed. No, I'm not.
Arrogant.
I'm not giving them an. I am not legitimizing their jerky actions. Okay, what they did was put us at risk.
Right.
I think they should be arrested. My point is that once we knew that no one from the administration was coming in, then guess what? You don't care if they compare and contrast notes. Let's start putting this out publicly. There is more mileage on this process of being clandestine right now, given the fact that they're not coming in. So guess what? Call them on the carpet. Say, okay, fine. It's open. Now what do they do?
Yes, I agree with that. It's much more in order to legitimize what's going on with the public, with public opinion.
Totally.
Where people can hear, if they want to, they can hear what these people who are professionals, they're not politicians, they're not Democrats, they're not liberals, they're not socialists.
Right.
They're public servants who have done right. this, many of them. Some of them have served 40 years. You know, even in Vietnam. I mean, yeah. I'm surprised there are still Vietnam veterans in the federal government. Yeah. I thought they were pretty much all dying out.
No. Taylor had actually retired. He came back because he was asked. Mm. Pompeo asked and pulled him out of retirement. So
incredible.
For them to call, I mean, it's incredible on so many levels. But more importantly, I want to remind everyone that, you know, Democrats keep talking about transparency and the value of transparency. And they talk about dark money. And they talk about what Donald Trump is doing. And they talk about that special server that Donald Trump put all this stuff on so nobody could see it, so it wouldn't be transparent. And at some point in time, you have to make your bed and lie in it. If you are going to believe and embrace transparency, then frickin' do it. But don't tell me transparent for this, but not for this. Transparent for that, but not for this. And I don't want to legitimize it, but once we saw that no member of the administration was going to come in, then guess what? Open the door.
Well, you're right about consistency, but this is a law enforcement operation. This is like a grand jury. You wouldn't say have the FBI open up all of their investigations and let the public and the media all watch them interrogate a witness before they brought charges.
That would be fun, actually.
Yeah, it'd be fun. Well, you know, but here's the problem. This is not about criminal activity.
Sure it is.
No, it's not. This is about political activity. This is, I mean, high crimes and misdemeanors is not a crime. It is not a crime. There isn't a crime on the books that's called high crimes and misdemeanors. It is a political decision. It is not a criminal decision. It might have some potential criminal impact. It might be a shakedown. It might be, you know, but in the end, it is political. And if it is political, don't use the FBI and the CIA, because what we are looking for is not a crime. What we are looking for is an explanation to the American people why this person should no longer be serving as president.
That's true. But if they're doing this grand jury type investigation as a deposition, then you don't get all that grandstanding. If they were in public, you'd have the Republicans. Every time a witness was talking about something, all the Republicans, they'd have to go around the room. Every one of the Republicans can make little speeches and muddy the waters and accuse Democrats of, you know, whatever, whatever. It would be a circus instead of a legal investigation.
All right. Before I let you go, Stefan, I do have one article that I wanted to just touch on, because I've been talking about the fires in California. And I saw an article from Reuters, and it was San Jose to propose turning PG&E into a giant customer-owned utility. So which I totally agree with. But here's the kicker. What they need to do is they need to bury all the lines. And that was suggested at the very beginning when they were putting in the electrical lines, and everyone said it was too expensive. Look what's too expensive today. The cost of one fire in 2018, that huge fire, cost $16.8 billion for the Camp Fire. Mm. One fire, Stefan. Tell me how much it would have cost to bury the lines. I want people to start playing at the consequences. You want to be cheap now? Well, guess what? Then your total environment is destroyed in the future. If we're going to accept the idea that we need electricity, then you got to live with the reality of it.
They're not even talking now about burying the lines.
I know.
They're talking about cutting off power to people that the power lines that are up there don't spark and set off other fires.
I know.
I mean, the basic problem is that California has dried out more than ever before,
exactly.
And so anything will set off a fire, like, you know, a car crash.
Yeah. Exactly.
And a barbecue grill.
But you have a combination of a lot of things happening, and the idea of then shutting people and having them go into the dark, that to me has even more consequences for people.
Mm-hmm.
Because they depend on electricity not just for their food and not just for their TV, but to keep certain people alive. So I think this is where we're going to have to start understanding. We decided that we wanted to cheap out in the beginning, and this is the consequences of our actions. And on that note, Stefan Schmidt, join us again.
Bye. Thank you.
You're welcome. And we end with?
We end with a little ditty called When the Swamp Gets Drained.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Here we go. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
When the swamp gets drained in the broad daylight, watch the fire little vermin as he's slithering and squirming, trying to get out of sight. When
the tide.